something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick, and we are back with our fourth episode in the series on dust. So we've covered a lot of ground already. If you have not heard the earlier episodes, you should probably go back and check those out first. But for a brief review, in part one of this series, we talked about how to define and classify dust according to particle size and how easily it is borne aloft in the air and so forth. We also talked about our domestic companions, the wonderful, beautiful, horrible pyroglyphid dust mites. We also talked about some of the complicated interactions between atmospheric dust and climate and weather. In part two, we talked about dust bunnies, both inside the home and potentially in outer space, as well as some historical attitudes about dust and how those attitudes relate to things like interior design and horror literature. And then in part three, we talked about the role of dust in urban Victorian London and in 19th century literature again, and also got into dust as an illustration of the philosophical puzzle known as the Sorites paradox, or the paradox of the heap. And now we're back today to talk more about dust. I think we're going to focus today primarily on dust, the role of dust in religion and mythology.
That's right. So at this point, I think we've cleanly established the ubiquitous nature of dust. You know, it precedes us, it follows us, and it steadily covers all the details of our lives. So on one level, dust is mundane and perhaps not all that worthy of careful consideration or dreaming or myth-making. But as we've also established, dust can also be quite beautiful. It can haunt us with its minuscule scale, its almost invisible accumulation, and it takes on additional meanings in the light than of both mythological and scientific explanations. So it's something that, yeah, it's everywhere, it's every day, but it also works in such a subtle way and can be quite beautiful that it does seem to attract this kind of dream-making attention.
You know, one thing I brought up in the first episode of this series was about a mismatch in the different ways we think about dust, because on one hand, dust as a symbol is most often used to symbolize kind of nothingness or worthlessness. You know, dust just means like it's sort of the opposite of meaningful, useful matter. Mm-hmm. It's just something that's everywhere and is worth nothing. At the same time, I sort of like what you're talking about, Rob, with dust being both mundane and all around us, but also seemingly sort of magical sometimes. I think it's interesting that dust has, even in its use as a symbol of meaninglessness or worthlessness, a real potency. Like it is considered so worthless that it is a really captivating image and it matters.
Yeah. And also, we'll get into this a little bit, too. There can also be, I think, a disconnect between the way we think about dust and related substances such as dirt and mud versus the way that people would have thought about it in the past, but more centrally in times and places where people were more connected with the earth. So at any rate, we're going to get into some various examples here, but we do need to stress that we cannot possibly cover every invocation of dust in mythic, legendary, folkloric, and religious traditions here. So we're going to try and cover some tantalizing examples, but we'll inevitably leave some things off, in which case, you know, that's an opportunity for folks to write into us and share other examples of dust from mythology, folklore, and so forth that we might find interesting and we can discuss on future listener mail episodes.
Exactly. Please send us your favorite dust myths that we do not cover. But I wanted to kick things off today by looking at the role of dust in Mesopotamian myths, because I just recalled off the top of my head a lot of striking imagery of dust in ancient Mesopotamian literature and also references in some of the religious rituals that we've talked about. Like, I know we talked about some of these last year in our in one of our Halloween episodes. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I was going to look up some of the most interesting references to dust in Mesopotamian literature. And so I ended up searching for references to dust in the Myths from Mesopotamia, Creation, the Flood, Gilgamesh, and Others from Oxford University Press, 1998, edited by Stephanie Daly. And the most interesting one that I came across is one you might know, the sort of famous House of Dust passage in the Gilgamesh epic. This is in Tablet 7 of the Gilgamesh story. And this imagery comes in when Gilgamesh's friend, the wild man Enkidu, is cursed and dying. Basically, he is being punished by the gods. The gods are getting revenge because the two of them both, Gilgamesh and Enkidu, for some reason only Enkidu gets punished here, they both attacked the demon Humbaba in the cedar forest, and they attacked another god too. They've been doing a lot of damage. They're a wild pair. So Enkidu is cursed by the gods. He's on his deathbed here, and he has a terrifying dream, a truly revolting and disturbing vision of the underworld, the land of the dead. And I'm not going to quote the whole thing here. I'm going to skip around a bit and pull out some passages from his description of the dream. And again, this is the translation in that Myths of Mesopotamia I described. Then Enkidu wept, for he was sick at heart. He lay down alone. He spoke what was in his mind to his friend. "Listen again, my friend. I had a dream in the night. The sky called out. The earth replied. I was standing between them. There was a young man whose face was obscured. His face was like that of an Anzu bird. He had the paws of a lion. He had the claws of an eagle. He seized me by my locks, using great force against me. Like a wild bull, he trampled on me. He squeezed my whole body. I cried out, 'Save me, my friend, don't desert me.' But you were afraid and did not help me. He seized me, drove me down to the dark house, dwelling of Erkala's god, to the house where those who stay are deprived of light, where dust is their food and clay their bread. They are clothed like birds with feathers, and they see no light, and they dwell in darkness. Over the door and the bolt, dust has settled."
Oh, wow.
So some of this does depend on the English translation, some of the, you know, the hauntingness. Like, you can read different translations of this passage that kind of hit in slightly different ways. Mm-hmm. And I will say that sometimes the word dust here is in some cases translated as dirt, but most often I've seen it as dust. And it really makes sense as dust when you think about the idea that, like, to this house of dust, to this land of darkness, over the door and the bolt, the dust has settled. It's a really striking, powerful, creepy image that, you know, it's like there's no coming and going. Anyway, Enkidu goes on to describe how great kings of the world have their crowns piled up in heaps in the underworld. Though I did wonder how many crowns makes a heap.
I love this detail, though. It is, like the steady accumulation of crowns. Much like the steady accumulation of dust.
And much like the dust, the crowns are now worthless in the underworld because the kings cannot wear them and they are not honored. The kings in the underworld are made to be servants, cooking meats and baking desserts and pouring cool water for the gods. But they cannot share in these delights themselves. For the dead, dust is their food and clay is their bread. So finally, in this passage, Enkidu does die from the god curse, and this vision of death is so awful that it drives Gilgamesh to go on his epic quest to discover the secret of immortality. And so he ends up, you know, searching for like a plant at the bottom of the ocean that he thinks can save him from death, because he cannot end up like Enkidu in the House of Dust. So it's literature like this that makes me think in some cases, the imagery of dust is used, of course, to signal something about worthlessness, like dust is not good as food. So it is not worthwhile as food. You do not want to be forced to eat it because it does not serve the function food should serve. But there is also a deeper meaning here. It's like there's a worthlessness deeper than mere trash or unwanted physical substance. There is a cosmic horror to this dust. The eating of the dust, it seems to me to symbolize a fear so deep that it can't even be articulated. It's the fear of that which is the opposite of vitality, the opposite of life, and the opposite of all meaning.
Yeah, yeah. It brings me back once again to that line from T.S. Eliot, I will show you fear in a handful of dust.
So it clearly can have something of this kind of significance. The House of Dust is a horrible place that Gilgamesh does not want to go. It's the end of everything good. But on the other hand, clearly dust doesn't always have this kind of significance even in people's magical and religious thinking.
That's right. So I thought we'll come back to some more fearful examples of dust. But first off, here's a pretty, I think, fun one and a mostly positive one. This is the idea of the Sandman's dust. So a lot of you are familiar with the nursery spirit known as the Sandman, who visits you each night to sprinkle sand into your eyes to cause you to sleep. And if you're like me, you've sort of long half heard this tale and or seen it in old Disney cartoons. I think there's one where Pluto, the dog, is visited by a canine Sandman, and you get to see all this play out in animated form. But if you're like me, you probably rarely pause to consider how weird this is, right? Because like
doesn't make any sense.
Sand in your eyes?
Seems like it would make it hard to sleep.
Yeah, like sand in your eyes is a bad thing. I think for the first time in my life, I was like, all right, well, what does this mean? So one of the first places I went was a Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable, which is always kind of a nice sort of first stop with some of these antiquated English sayings. And the idea here, apparently, is that one becomes sleepy, especially children, and what do? You rub your eyes as if you have sand or dust in them. Yep. And I think this is key too. Sandman maybe sounds more abrasive. Dustman and the idea of dust in your eyes is ultimately, I think, more where this is based. And indeed, the Sandman is also known as the Dustman. And Brewers includes examples of sayings that would have invoked the Dustman. So you might have a situation where I suppose you might be becoming sleepy, or more likely there are children becoming sleepy. And you might say something like, oh, the Dustman has arrived.
That's so creepy. What child wants to hear that?
Oh, I don't know. It doesn't strike me as too nefarious here. Carol Rose has an entry on the entity in her book, Spirits, Fairies, Leprechauns, and Goblins, which is an excellent encyclopedia of fairies and fair folk sorts of creatures. And she describes the dust in question as magic dust, and it ensures not only sleep, but ultimately pleasant dreams. She mentions that the Dustman in Danish and Swedish lore is known as Ole Luk Oi, which means, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, Ole, close your eyes. And in this tradition, he is a tiny elf or fairy in a silk jacket that changes color with the light, which I like that detail because to me, it makes me think of what we've been discussing about, you know, motes of dust being caught in a ray of light and having this ethereal quality. Mm-hmm. And so what does he do? He comes up and he blows magic dust into a child's eyes and onto their neck. This makes your eyelids heavy and makes your head heavy. You can't hold your head up straight anymore. So it's time to go to bed. And then once you're in bed, once you're safely a snooze, he'll come to your bed and open up a magical umbrella over you. And there will be all these wonderful pictures on the underside of the umbrella that will fill your dreams with wonderful stories. Now, isn't that delightful?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not true for naughty kids, however, but it's not too bad. You know, naughty kids can have a pretty hard time in these sorts of tales. But according to Rose, naughty kids just get a standard umbrella. So it's not the umbrella with beautiful stories on the underside of it. It's just an umbrella. So no special dreams for you, but also you're not like chased around by, some strange demons or anything. And of course, there are other varieties of this sort of spirit in European tradition, but they don't all use dust, and they certainly don't all use umbrellas.
I had no idea Sandman went this deep. I did not think there was associated lore.
Yeah. It runs pretty deep.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, for the next few examples, we're going to get more into this connection between some sort of magical dust and the dust of the dead, which does seem to be a common motif that you find in traditions all over the world. And it makes sense. You know, it gets down to this basic, you know, ashes to ashes sort of observation about the nature of matter in our world. The first one is something that's generally referred to as goofer or goofer dust. Sometimes it's spelled G-O-O-F-E-R, and other times it's spelled G-O-O-P-H-E-R. And I was reading about this in an article on the Low Country Digital History Initiative website. This is affiliated with South Carolina's College of Charleston, titled Spiritual Practices in the Low Country, discussing African-American religious practices in the antebellum and postbellum periods. These are particular traditions that are sometimes referred to broadly as hoodoo. And the article here discusses conjuring magic of West and West Central African origin that enslaved peoples practiced outside of or alongside Christian religious traditions. It notes individuals given the title of Gufer Doctor, the term seemingly related to the Congo word Kufwa, meaning to die. And I was really reading elsewhere in Folk Belief and Custom in the Blues by Mimi Clar, published in Western Folklore back in 1960, that describes this Gufer dust as a powder to be burned in a kind of long-distance conjuring of illness, and mentions that the powder is generally associated with graves. And by long distance, I mean, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be cross-country, but just like the target is not maybe physically present at the conjuring. Now, the next one I want to touch on is a concept involving a kind of corpse dust in Navajo traditions. So a while back, I was researching a topic related to rituals and folk beliefs of the Navajo people. In various sources I reached out to pointed me in the direction of a work by an anthropologist by the name of Clyde Kluckhohn, who lived 1905 through 1960, particularly his book Navajo Witchcraft from 1944. The version I have is a publication from 1989, and I think there were some additions made. I'm not sure if those additions were made in the 80s or if they had been made previously in the 1960s, however. So Kluckhohn's anthropology work was very well regarded, but I do want to, again, stress that the time frame of the work in question here. So he worked among the Navajo people during the 1930s and the late 1920s. That's when his field work took place. But, you know, he was an outsider working within those communities. And this is not like modern anthropological work, but it's still fascinating. And he uses Western terms such as witchcraft in discussing these magical concepts, though he himself wrote that this term was not completely accurate, it's more of a dependence on a broadly comparable Western concept to understand or discuss what is occurring in Navajo culture. And he suggested that a more precise description would be, quote, Navajo idea and action patterns concerned with the influencing of events by supernatural techniques that are socially disapproved. So what we're talking about here is not something you would want to confuse with other examples of Navajo rituals and beliefs. This would be like a subset of those in which the techniques were generally disapproved of, or I would say even broadly disapproved of.
But also with that caveat, you would want to be careful not to apply all of the connotations that you might apply to witchcraft in, say, the Renaissance European context or something.
Yeah, in general, the term witch and witchcraft can become complicated when you start like applying it to actual practices instead of fantastic practices, you know, imagined fictional practices and practices that were dreamed up by men in the persecution of women and also of indigenous religions and so forth. Anyway, Kluckhohn here, concerning witchcraft, he reports on beliefs and traditions concerning Adante. These would be men and women that were thought to pursue a sort of morally descendant path to magical power. The path of the Adante, the witchery way, as the author describes it here, is a path of death, desecration, poison, and beast forms. It also sometimes involves a special preparation of dust. He describes the alleged use of a preparation, often translated as a poison, ground from corpses and said to look like pollen. Quote, it may be dropped into a hogan from the smoke hole, placed in the nose or mouth of a sleeping victim, or blown from furrowed sticks into the face of someone in a large crowd. Now, depending on the telling of the story, there may be immediate symptoms such as the blackening of the tongue or lockjaw, but in other tellings, there's nothing so obvious. But generally, the way it's supposed to go is that the victim begins to waste away and ultimately dies. The witchery way, he writes, is pursued for various reasons, including vengeance, the pursuit of riches, and the riches would primarily be obtained via grave robbing, or something he discusses as fee splitting, in which an Adante would partner with a healer and then split the healer's fee. So basically something like an illness scam with a healer where you're like, I'll cause the illness and you treat the illness and you just give me half of what they pay you to treat it.
Mm.
But other Adante seemingly pursued a more chaotic, evil path, just doing harm for the sake of doing harm. Now, I want to note here that the Clicquot himself in the book, it made no claim that witchcraft and sorcery, as cited in these examples, were indeed actually practiced. You know, it's, you know, ultimately a lot of mystery here, but rather what we can focus on are that these were stories and traditions. These were stories told. These were ideas that were discussed, you know, concerning unexplained illness, superstition, suspicion of other individuals. And he writes at length in the book about the various reasons for so-called witchcraft traditions in a given culture, including various social functions, the management of anxiety, and more. So, you know, his treatment ultimately is not saying, like, here's this weird story, look how weird it is. It's also not, here's this thing that is said, people definitely did this. It's more complicated than that. But I mainly wanted to focus on the idea that here is another culture where we see some idea of a corpse-derived dust being used in, you know, magical rituals of one sort or another.
That are socially disapproved of within the culture in which these stories originate.
Right. In this case, in this particular case with the Adante, this would be someone who is doing, you know, bad, socially reprehensible magic. And therefore, the idea that they're using some sort of a corpse powder seems based in that. But there are other examples we find around the world where the corpse dust takes on a different air. And so, continuing this theme of magical dust connected to the bodies of the dead, let's turn to some European traditions that get into this. I was looking at a paper titled Dynamic Dirt, Medieval Holy Dust, Ritual Erosion, and Pilgrimage Ecopoetics. This is by Susan Signe Morrison, published in Special Collection Waste, Disposability, Decay, and Depletion from 2019.
Oh boy, are we about to get into some crumbly saints?
Yes. So this is a really, really good write-up. I really enjoyed this. The author stresses, first of all, that the dust and dirt are pretty key to religious pilgrimage. In this case, focusing on medieval European traditions, pilgrimage by its very nature just ends up altering geography. You have a bunch of people, you know, trooping along towards some holy site, you know, trampling the earth. What's going to happen? They're going to stir up dust. They're going to spread dust. They're going to carry away mud. They're going to erode things. That's just how it goes.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, I don't know how far back this tradition goes, but I mean, you certainly can see the idea of like earth from a holy site being removed and jarred and taken abroad to, I don't know, carry some of that holiness with it.
Yeah. And she gets into some of that. And to call back to Dracula, you know, again, the idea that Dracula in Bram Stoker's novel must travel with dirt from his homeland. You know, there is kind of like the inversion of the holy dirt here, the holy dust.
He's got to take his unholy dust in a coffin with him.
Yeah. So she gets into this idea that I found really compelling that I hadn't really thought about as much. And that's that a people's attitude toward dust, dirt, and related substances may be substantially different if the people in question live in close confines with the natural world, you know, be it agriculture or some other mode of the natural world that makes them aware of how dirt and manure are bound to the production of food. So she points out that while manure might be seen more as a pure waste product by modern and urban standards, medieval Europeans would have had a more, quote, redemptive view of manure. So it's not an end product, but a transition, a beginning even in some ways.
Yeah, you got to feel differently about a substance if you have a use for it.
Yeah. And then when, you know, aspects of the sacred and the holy are applied, it's perhaps a little easier for dirt and dust to take on the air of healing. And it certainly does in some of these tales and some of these traditions. Now, she also points out here that one thing to keep in mind, too, is that within a culture, you might have different classifications for soil. So it's not like you just have dirt. You just have soil. You may have different types of soil. And perhaps that also opens up room for some soils to have healing qualities and be rather different in character compared to other soils. Anyway, she ultimately discusses two sorts of dust and dirt that I think are of note here for us. The first is dirt that has come into contact with the bodies, the blood, or other substances of holy individuals. So in the same way that the finger of a deceased saint may be deemed holy, the dirt that soaked up their blood also becomes holy.
Mm.
And she cites two different descriptions here from the English monk, the Venerable Bede, who lived 672 or 673 through 735. We've talked about Bede briefly on the show before, I believe.
Yes.
So here's the first one. "And when he had reverently deposited these relics, Germanus took away with him a portion of the earth from the place where the blessed martyr's blood had been shed." The martyr here is one Alban, by the way. "The earth was seen to have retained the martyr's blood, which had reddened the shrine where his persecutor had grown pale with fear." And this next one is really good, too.
Okay.
"At the place where he," and the he is King Oswald here, "was killed fighting for his country against the heathen, sick men and beasts are healed to this day. Many people took away the very dust from the place where his body fell and put it in water, from which sick folk who drank it received great benefit. This practice became so popular that, as the earth was gradually removed, a pit was left in which a man could stand. Many miracles are reported as having occurred at this spot or by means of the earth taken from it."
I feel like this is the kind of belief that you can't think too concretely about, because if it's like literally the blood had to touch the particle of dust you're taking, if by the time you got a pit a man can stand in, that earth is not there anymore.
Yeah.
So like what's, I don't know. So, but I guess there's enough that like by magical association, just any earth from the place is good enough.
Yeah. It's kind of like just our magical associations with geographical locations in general, you know, like if you go to the place where, say, a famous person died, say, I don't know, like the place where John Lennon died or something to that effect, you know, in many cases, these places, even assuming that it's 100% geographically correct, Even if it's exactly where this person died or something happened, in many cases the environment has been changed. You know, there is now a plaque there. Maybe the concrete has been changed. Since people were going there, you have to do things to keep from eroding everything. So it's, you know, we lean into the magic of it. I am here where this thing happened, and therefore I am closer to sort of the idea of the event, the spirit of the event, and so forth.
Yeah.
Now, I guess this shouldn't feel shocking. I imagine within a faith that includes the doctrine of transubstantiation, you know, the idea that the matter of communion is or becomes the flesh and blood of Christ in the body. But also, again, it plays into this understanding of ashes to ashes that we see in other traditions, and you know, it gets into this idea of the transitional nature of dirt and soil. So it's not purely tied to theoretical matters, but it also may be tied to sort of ecological realities, you know, things that would have been sort of observable about dirt and soil in the cycle of life in the world around you. Now, another area she gets into, though, is that there's also just dust that gathers on certain holy relics. And this dust in and of itself, in some contexts, is thought to be holy. So it's often called tomb dust, and it will settle on reliquaries of saints and also within actual tombs. And I found this quite fascinating because it seems to line up with some of these ideas we've talked about concerning the natural accumulation of dust in a house or other human space, you know, the at times invisible aspect of this accumulation, as well as the ethereal nature of glimpsing those motes of dust floating in a ray of sunlight, which I was thinking too, it was like, oh, this is, it's kind of like the golden rain of Zeus, which is sometimes described as golden dust. I think it's more oftentimes described as a rain or a shower of gold, but sometimes as golden dust, this being the form that Zeus takes to impregnate the mortal princess Danae.
Oh yeah, the mother of Perseus and the mm-hmm. Perseus myth. Yeah, so his father is immortal because Zeus comes. It is off it, the version of the myth I knew. It was said to be like a shower of gold from the sky. I think pouring into the window of the room where she was imprisoned by her father.
Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes it's described as dust. I was looking around to see if there was a source that really went all in on this and discussed the, you know, comparisons to dust in one's environment, but I couldn't find anything offhand. It may be out there, and I didn't find it.
That makes sense, yeah. Dust floating in a ray of sunlight, that seems like that's a shower of gold, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's see. What other examples here do I have to share? I did run across a few in Chinese traditions. So I was looking at the Handbook of Chinese Mythology by Yang and An, and they mentioned that there is, this is only mentioned in passing, but there was a popular tradition among the Uyghur people of Central and East Asia that holds that a goddess inhaled the dust and air of the universe and then like exhaled or spat out the sun, the moon, the earth, the stars, and like all humans. Elsewhere in this book, they mention various Han Chinese myths that allude to the need to regularly wash the sun and moon, as even the sun and moon acquire dust over time. And this is also mm-hmm. echoed, and I think in some other traditions, in various other Chinese ethnic groups. Now, I was reminded of something that, this is actually something I discussed on the podcast years and years ago, an episode on poisons that I did with Christian. But I went back and looked at the source again. It was titled, The Miao and Poison Interactions on China's Southwest Frontier by Norma Diamond. This was published in a 1988 edition of Ethnology. And this one gets, it basically deals with various ideas of poison in this border country. And I'm not necessarily going to get into all of this again. I think the episode was titled The Six Deadly Poisons, where we talked about different poisons. She discusses this idea of Gu folklore from the Tang Dynasty. So this would have been 618 CE onward. And in particular, you have this idea of the five poisonous creatures. So in this idea, Gu, this special poison, was kind of a quasi-magical poison created by a kind of, by this process that I think aligns with some of these kind of like Western alchemical processes that we've talked about, you know, where clearly what we're describing here is impossible, but it has kind of like the trappings of chemical ritual and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, about some types of alchemy, we've noticed how it's interesting that it's a kind of not efficacious magical belief that in some forms is grasping toward actual chemistry.
Yeah. Now, in this particular instance, the idea was what you do is you seal the five poisonous creatures together inside a jar. So you throw in your snake, your centipede, your toad, your scorpion, and your lizard. And I'm assuming we're dealing with specific venomous or poisonous examples of these creatures. And then you keep this jar in a dark place for a year. During this time, the creatures are going to eat each other until there's only one survivor. They're going to become a tredunken of poisonous creatures.
Tredunken.
Yeah, like the, what is it?
A turducken.
Turducken, sorry. I've never had one, so I...
me neither.
It's not really on the menu for me anymore.
I don't know why, but it's a ridiculous food.
Trudunken? Is it Trudunken or Turducken?
I think it's Turducken
because it's turkey.
Turd. It has turd in there.
It's got turd in there, that's great.
Yeah. Okay. Turducken.
Okay.
Because so, it's a chicken, a duck, and a turkey.
Well, this is like that, except poisonous creatures. And so they all eat each other. Then there's one left, but it's in a dark jar for a year. So that creature dies. Mm-hmm. And then when you open it up, I guess you have this like one little mummified creature with like magically potent poison inside of it. So you ground that up into a powder. And this is the goo poison that causes sickness and death.
So it's like the most poisonous dust in the world.
Yeah. And it ties into various ideas, superstitions, and I think accusations of indigenous peoples on the border using poisons to make people sick, using them in a place and a time where the border country would, you know, have a lot of strife. There would be conflict. There would be also a collision of cultures and a certain amount of xenophobia and accusations of witchcraft. But as Diamond gets into in this article, there also are theories about, well, if there was an actual poison, what could it have been? Not something made by forcing poisonous creatures to eat each other and then grounding up the victor, but rather something maybe based in the use of arsenic or various other substances.
Would this be trying to infer what it might possibly have been if it was real from like literary sources?
Yes. Yeah. Looking at literary sources and then looking at what is known about, say, actual plants that were available at that time, some of which would have been used in like traditional medicine. And of course, we know that a lot of things used in traditional medicine, as in, you know, any kind of medical practice, like the quantity is key. And
yes,
something that could otherwise be a poison can also be a treatment and so forth.
As they said, yeah, the dose makes the poison.
Yeah. And so ultimately, though, the idea is you could have some sort of a poisonous powder that then could be like snuck into someone's food or their tent or forced on them while they're asleep, that sort of thing. Lining up, you know, with the idea of the Navajo corpse powder that we discussed earlier. And I think more broadly, kind of getting into this realization that sometimes there are particles in the air that might not be good for us, you know, and without a germ theory, without, real scientific knowledge to go on, you just kind of had to sort of guess. Like it was certainly we had this idea you see in various parts of the world of bad air, harmful air, Or I was reading in Navajo traditions, you have this idea sometimes of there being like various types of wind. I was looking at a book titled Holy Wind in Navajo Philosophy by James Cale McNelly. And like sometimes a wind would have like a bad smell to it that might be associated with dead animals or said to emerge from the mouths of animals. And so, yeah, it's like I think there's a certain amount of trying to make sense of how the air or things in the air can influence human health and or behavior. And in some cases, it might be connected to nefarious individuals within your group or just outside of your group.
Yeah. But as we've talked about on the show before, that like in a way, various kinds of beliefs about bad wind or bad air or bad smells being related to sickness are getting halfway there. Like they're picking up on something. Like you can inhale things that make you sick. People inhale droplets and airborne, germs and get sick that way. There can be like, if you fear the swamp air, maybe it's not the swamp air that's going to hurt you, but there might be mosquitoes in there that could give you malaria or some other disease. And so even though these beliefs didn't get the full way there, it does seem like they may have been based on picking up some kind of correlation.
Yeah, like you didn't catch cholera because the open latrine smelled bad.
It's because you were drinking the water. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, a lot of times these things seem to get halfway to the truth and sometimes enough to where you're getting results by implementing them. All right, on that note, I think we're going to go ahead and close up this episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Again, we couldn't possibly get into all of the mythologies, legends, folkloric ideas, and so forth concerning dust. So if you have additional ones you want to bring up, or if you have added insight on anything we've discussed here, certainly write in. We'd love to discuss it on a future episode of Listener Mail. Our Listener Mail episodes publish every Monday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. Our core episodes of Science and Culture are on Tuesdays and Thursdays, a short form episode on Wednesdays, and on Fridays we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.